Okay, so you should be able to hear me. So thank you for arranging for that. And thanks to the church, too, because it looks like next week we're going to actually have dual projectors coming in here, and they're very nice projectors. So we're going to try to get that wired up so that we can do that for you starting next week. And, of course, I won't have to bring this projector anymore. You'll really see the difference. We may need to dim the lights a bit so you can see this. Next time that won't be necessary, but for today it will be. And for those of you that are new, we're going through the different creation texts in the Bible. We started with Genesis 1, then moved to Genesis 2, and all the way through the other creation texts in Genesis. And then we went through those in the book of Job, and now we're in those that are in the Psalms. Psalms has got more creation texts than any other book of the Bible. So we're now in Psalm 139, and we've got two more Psalms to look at, 147 and 148. Before we move to Proverbs chapter 8. But Psalm 139, the entire creation text is devoted to the theme of humanity and human origins. And so what I'm doing now is kind of taking you through a keynote presentation on what anthropologists and geneticists have learned about the origin of humanity over the past 10 years. And so let me just pick it up with this one because it ties into a discovery that was announced in the journal Science Liturgy just this Friday. In fact, they published 8 papers on the discovery of Australopithecus sediba. Actually, it's not so much a new discovery because sediba was announced as a discovery literally a little more than a year ago. In fact, if you go on our website, Fuzz Rana did 2 podcasts on that discovery. So you can go to our website. Just put Australopithecus sediba in or put in anthropology or human origins. You should be able to pop it right up because a lot of people ask us, how come you didn't do a podcast this Friday? Well, there's really nothing new in these 8 papers that we didn't talk about a year ago. But I think what generated the excitement is what is new is they've come up with what they believe to be a very accurate date for Australopithecus sediba, namely 1.977 million years ago, plus or minus 2,000 years. So it's now accurate to 4 places the decimal. It's also generated the excitement because now they know that this Australopithecus sediba falls in the right time period for where they've been trying to find, quote, the missing link, the link between the Australopithecine species and what they call the Homo species. And, you know, Homo erectus, who's probably the oldest of the Homo species, goes back to about 1.8 million years, although some people think that there are fossils that may date as early as 2 million years, which would be the same date as this. Whereas the Australopithecines typically fall around 3.2 to 3.9 million years ago. So that's what generated the excitement. And that's why there's 8 papers in Friday's edition of Science. Now, to just underline the significance of that, a big discovery in science is published every week. It's one of the premier science journals in the world. If it's a big discovery, they'll publish 2 articles. If it's a breakthrough, they publish 3. This one got 8 papers. 5 papers published by the research teams. Then they had 3 other papers written by people who are not part of the team who commented on the discovery. So, and it's being promoted as, quote, the solution to the missing link problem. And, of course, it's all over the web. But what I'm going to do is report to you what's actually in the science research papers and the comments from the people who did the research rather than what you're going to hear in the various blogs and newspaper writings on it. And in particular, which you'll see in the newspaper, I think it's in virtually every newspaper in America, is they're announcing this as a brand new discovery. Well, that's not true. It's literally a little more than a year old. It's been around for some time. It's not catching the anthropological community by surprise. They've known about this for some time. It's really the date that's generating the excitement. Now, there again, the dates are accurate, but they're not necessarily pertaining to the actual fossil bones. Because what they dated was the calcite material in which the fossils were found. And it doesn't necessarily follow that the site of burial, or the material in the burial site, is equal to the date of the actual bones. That's a presumption. Now, we don't know whether that's true or not. There are no dates based on the bones themselves. Although it's possible we may be able to get some dates through further research. But typically, when you date bones of hominid fossils that are like 1 to 3 million years old, you don't get very accurate dates. You're really doing well if it's like plus or minus 30, 40, 50%. This one was a tenth of a percent precision, which is what generated all the excitement. But there again, it's an accurate date for the calcite material in which the bones were found. If the calcite material was laid down at the same time as the bones, then you got an accurate date. But if that's not the case, then who knows what the date is. So in that sense, this announcement has been blown out of proportion by quite a degree. But why they're calling it the missing link is that it's got some features that look human-like and some features that look like the Australopithecines. And when I say human-like, I'm again referring to what I said last week. Homo sapiens is a term that's used for a broad range of different species of bipedal primates. A lot of lay people think Homo sapiens is identical to human beings. The term that scientists use for human beings is Homo sapiens sapiens. And so, again, you got to watch when they say a human find. It's something that simply may be bipedal. But to give you the actual data, and this is what I found interesting when I went on the web, is that they were talking about the brain of this Australopithecus sediba, but they really weren't giving you any details. If you actually read the papers that are published in Science, there you get the details. And brain size has been accurately measured to like 1% precision. And this creature comes in with a brain size of 420 cubic centimeters. Now, to put that in context, if we were to take the men in this room, we would average out to about 1,600 cubic centimeter brain size. So this is about a fourth the size of a human being. And that's what they were calculating, the size of an adult male for this particular species. So that ratio is about right. But, you know, the standard evolutionary model is that you're going to see brain sizes getting progressively larger and larger with respect to time. So the first bipedal primate species we see dated 6.5 million years ago, and they have a brain size that's slightly bigger than a chimpanzee. Where does a chimpanzee come in? Comes in at about 380, 390 cubic centimeters. And so when you go back 6.5 million years, it's coming in just a little bit bigger than a chimpanzee. And then the whole idea is that you go from 6.5 million years up to human beings, the brain size gets progressively bigger and bigger. Now, what we really mean is the encephalization quotient, which is how big the brain is relative to the typical male body mass. So, for example, it is true that Neanderthals have a cranial capacity that's equivalent to human beings. However, they're much heavier than human beings, and so we human beings have what's called a higher brain-to-body mass ratio than Neanderthals. And that's really what counts in terms of intellectual capability, assuming that the brain cells are actually devoted to that capacity. There's actually quite a bit of evidence that the Neanderthals had much better senses than we human beings, better sense of smell, sight, hearing, etc., and therefore much more of their brain was devoted to supporting the senses and certainly to supporting the muscles, because they were much more muscular than we are, and therefore, even though they have brains the same size as ours, not as much of the brain could be devoted to intellectual capabilities. But to give you the data, Australopithecus africanus, which is one of the older of the Australopithecines, coming in about 3.5 million years ago, has a cranial capacity for an average adult that comes in at 459 cubic centimeters. Followed by Australopithecines afarensis that comes in at 481. Now, there's a little bit of debate whether one follows the other. They're kind of roughly the same. The dates are in dispute, but we're talking roughly 3 to 3.5 million years ago. One is at 459, one is at 481. And so you jump ahead 1 to 1.5 million years, you actually got an Australopithecus with a smaller brain, 420. So it's actually against the evolutionary paradigm, because instead of the brain size getting progressively larger and larger, it kind of sits around a little bit beyond the chimpanzee, and you go from above 400 up to above 460, 480, and then it drops down to 420 with this new find. Yes?
Couldn't that maybe be accounted for just variation due within a genotype?
Like, well,
human beings range from what, 12 to 16?
There has been dispute about, because you know the data indicates that Afarensis has a slightly bigger brain than Africanus. And you're right, it may be just a statistical artifact because we have so few fossil finds of these creatures, and seldom do you have a complete skull. It's usually just part of a skull. But that was some of the excitement about Australopithecus subita, is that with the juvenile male, they had virtually a complete skull. So they're actually able to measure with some precision the size of the brain. They knew the maturity. They had an adult female where they had part of the skull. And so they were able to actually come up with a more accurate measure to the cranial capacity for subiba than they were for Africanus or Afarensis. But even there, you're looking at just two specimens. So it's possible that there might be variation, because after all, if you look at the men and women in the audience, our brain sizes vary quite a bit. Some of you've got small brains, some of you've got bigger brains. And by the way, when they say men have bigger brains and therefore are smarter, not necessarily the case. Again, what counts is the encephalization ratio. Women have smaller body masses than men. What's going on here? And then men have more muscles to support, so naturally your brains are a little bit bigger than women. But the amount of the brain is devoted to intellectual capabilities is about the same for each.
What's the range?
Oh, literally, for human beings, it can run from 800 up to about 1,800. So it's quite a big range, although it's rare to have some that are down around the 800 ratio. Yes. I mean, after all, there are people, like when I was traveling to Asia, I met a number of individuals that were less than 4 feet tall. And there the encephalization ratio would mean you'd have a smaller brain than you would for, say, if you're going to the Netherlands, where the average height is like 6'1.5". So that sense, again, you need the ratio counts more than the actual size of the brain. But even in this room, I would guess there'd be at least a 30% variation in our brain volume. And by the way, people who have bigger brains than others, it doesn't translate to intellectual capability.
Are the atheists at the low end?
I'll let that one go, okay? we can get into some political jokes here too, but we're going to avoid all that, all right?
Now,
keep in mind that the people who listen to this class are much bigger than the people that are actually here. And so you may want to watch what you say, because it is broadcast, it's up on the web. So, of course, that might make you say more than, I don't know. But I think what got the researchers excited was, one, the brain size was a little bit smaller, so it was disturbing to the evolutionary paradigm, but what they thought that was encouraging the evolutionary paradigm is that the brain structure looked different. And what they were able to see is that with the male juvenile of the Sidiba find, is that it had more of the brain structured in front of the eyes. And so there were some of the researchers that said maybe this is akin to the human frontal lobe. Again, that's a presupposition. That may not be the case. And we do see other animals that have the brain volume larger in front of the eyes than you do for other species, where it doesn't translate into greater intellectual capability at all. But it is true that we see this. And it is, again, out of whack with the evolutionary paradigm. This is what you're going to hear from Fuzz Rana, if you get the podcast, that it's really showing this, that the fossil record is not a tree. We're not seeing a gradual development in terms of the complex structure of the cranial capacity or the brain size. It's actually going in the opposite direction. And when we look at the bipedal primates, it's really a hedge. It's not a tree. Because we're seeing, say, bipedalism capability, dexterity of the hand, the brain size, the brain structure. It varies all over the place, and it can't be put together in any kind of tree. And this is one of the prime examples we have of a bipedal primate that's got the wrong date for the features we're seeing showing up. Now, what was interesting in looking at the peer-reviewed papers is that there were a number of researchers who said, you know, this is not the missing link. In fact, this is proof that we're probably never going to find a missing link. What we're seeing here is an example of an evolutionary convergence, what they call convergent evolution, where we're seeing different unrelated species of life developing the same structures in a way that can't be attributed to any kind of evolutionary paradigm. And in fact, you can listen to a podcast on our website where we interviewed for 2 hours the fellow who's most responsible for developing the convergent evolutionary paradigm. I'm trying to think of the guy's name. Rich, you might be able to help me. It was a fellow in Britain. He wrote a whole book on convergent evolution. He's actually a theistic evolutionist, because he looks at all these examples of convergent evolution and says it's got to be the hand of God. It can't be attributed to just pure evolutionary mechanisms. But for the life of me, I can't remember it. He's one who's been famous for debating Stephen Gould, where they have different ideas about how evolution works. But this would be according to one of the researchers who is responsible for this study. He said, not a missing link, it's convergent evolution. Or if you listen to Fuzz Rana, what convergent evolution really means is repeated design outcome. In other words, we're seeing species unrelated from an evolutionary paradigm having the exact design features. And you know, how can this be something that can be attributed to some kind of naturalistic random outcome? Now let me go on and describe some of the other things that don't fit the evolutionary paradigm. It's not just that the brain complexity doesn't fit this tree model, or the brain size doesn't fit. It's also true that the hand doesn't fit, because what they saw with this creature is it had a long thumb and short fingers. And that's kind of what distinguishes human beings from, say, chimpanzees. And it's the long thumb and the short fingers that allows us to grip things and gives us dexterity. Although if you actually look at the Science Journal, you'll notice that the thumb is about as long as the finger. So it's not exactly like a human one. The thumb seems a bit too long, and it's also a little on the frail side compared to a human thumb. Because you notice our thumb has bigger bones and is more muscular and is a little shorter than our fingers. We're not seeing this for Australopithecus sediba, but nevertheless, it's something completely unexpected. Because when you look at the other bipedal primates, we don't see that hand structure until you come up to, say, the Neanderthals or Homo sapiens I dealt with, and with human beings. And so this is showing up before Homo erectus, that you have this apparently advanced hand. That's what they refer to it in the article, an advanced hand. And they're claiming that this creature may have had very good tool-making dexterity. Again, that's a presupposition. Now, all they got is the bones of the one hand. We don't know what the muscular structure is like or the tendons are like. It's simply a guess that it might be having a greater dexterity. And the other thing they note in the paper, they haven't found any tools yet. So if it's got a higher dexterity, there's as yet no evidence that this thing was making or constructing tools. On the other hand, when you read the paper, they haven't looked for the tools yet. So that's kind of going to be the next step. They're going to try to see if they can find any tools. But there again, you've got to be careful, because whenever they find tools, The trick is trying to guarantee that the tools you're finding are associated with the species you're looking at. And so in the anthropological literature, it's ripe with cases where they attributed a set of tools to the wrong species. And the problem is there's certain sites which different species of bipedal primates will use. That's been a problem in the Siberian caves, for example. I think you can figure out why. If you're in Siberia, you're going to want a cave. A cave is a nice place to try to survive against the elements, but it's not just, say, Neanderthals that use the cave. We know that Denisova man used the cave. Humans use the cave. Bears use the cave. Everybody uses the caves. And so you see all these remains in the caves, and the trick is to figure out what can be attributed to the bear, what can be attributed to the Neanderthal, to the human beings, which tool is what. And it's, you know, it's difficult to date these tools. And so, anyway, they're going to be looking for tools, but if they find the tools, it doesn't necessarily follow that they were built or used by this particular species. The other thing that really caused some consternation for the evolutionists was the pelvis. Now, it was the female they were most interested in, because the evolutionary paradigm is that as the brain size gets bigger and bigger, the female pelvis will flatten and get shorter, so that when they're giving birth, they can actually give birth to an offspring that has a large brain. You know, and humans are at the extreme end, because when a woman gives birth to her child, the brain size of that child is one-third the size of an adult. And so all of you ladies who have given birth, you know that it's the passage of the head that causes the greatest trauma, because that head is really big. And, you know, of all species of life, you know, in terms of the mammals that develop, you know, our children are born with enormous brains. That's not... Pardon me? Well, yeah, you got to stick to the scriptures. But you know, when it tells us in Genesis 3 that when Adam and Eve sinned, the man, Adam, was going to have to work harder, and the woman was going to experience more pain in childbirth, that we need to realize that, you know, the women don't get off scot-free on the hard work, right? I mean, all of you ladies can testify that you just have to work as hard as the men. And so when God is pronouncing the curse upon humanity as a consequence of their sin, the curse is generic to all human beings. And this is something my wife pointed out to me when she gave birth. She gave birth twice to rather giant boys. I mean, you've seen my wife, many of you. She's not a big woman. And she gave birth to, her first son was 9 pounds, 2 ounces, 23 and a half inches long, and he was born skinny. There wasn't any fat on him. It was all big bones. And she went through considerable trauma in giving birth to Joel. And then when David came along, he was 9 pounds, 7 ounces, also 23 and a half inches long. So that was a traumatic birth, too. But, you know, years later, she shared with me that when Genesis talks about the pain of childbirth, it's really not the physical pain. Because, you know, when you're going through childbirth, yes, it's painful for many hours, but then there's that great sense of joy when that you get to hold that child and look into his eyes. I mean, to me, that was one of the most wonderful things about childbirth, being the father. I was the first to hold my son and just have looking into his eyes. You know what? I could tell the personality of each of our sons within the first few minutes that they were born. And there's something joyous about that. And so you say, where's the pain in childbirth? But as my wife pointed out, the pain in childbirth comes later, when you watch your children go their own way and do things you know are not in their best interest. And that's the real pain of childbirth. And the husband participates in that just as much as the wife. Just like the wife participates in the extra work just as much as the husband. So, anyway, that's what Genesis is really talking about. It's not talking about the anatomy of childbirth. However, let's get back to the anatomy of childbirth. The evolutionary paradigm was that as these bipedal primates evolve and wind up having bigger and bigger brains, that the pelvis is going to widen and flatten out for the females. And you can understand why they were quite shocked when they looked at Australopithecus sediba with a brain size of an adult of only 420 cubic centimeters, which means you're probably looking at something a little more than 100 for the baby, and yet it had this wide, flat pelvis. And it's the first time they've seen this with a bipedal primate where the pelvis didn't match the expected brain size of the offspring. And so, again, a challenge to the evolutionary paradigm. And the researchers who looked at this said, there's got to be something going on more than brain size is generating this, because clearly this species didn't need that pelvis to give birth to her children. And so then they were thinking maybe there's a dual design in the wide, flat pelvis, because after all, we men have a wide, flat pelvis. By the way, not as wide and flat as the women here. But they're now recognizing that maybe there's some bipedal advantage in having a pelvis that is wide and short. And they're still doing research on it. They don't know whether that's true or not, but the presumption is there may be a dual design feature here. Now, we've been talking about this in the class, how when God creates these advanced animals, quite frequently he builds in dual and triple design features. And this would be the mark of a creator as opposed to the mark of some evolutionary outcome. So the fact that we're seeing optimized designs serving two different purposes simultaneously is exactly what you'd expect from a creation perspective. So, but again, if you look at the articles that are all over the web that are written by lay people, they're touting this as the discovery of a missing link. But if you actually read the research papers in Science and some of the commentary from the researchers, they're saying probably not. What we're looking at here is yet another example of a repeated design outcome, which is something that fits a creation model, not an evolutionary model. And once again, it's underlying the point that we gave you last week. And when you look at the bipedal primates, this is what you see, not what the evolutionists would predict. The fossil tree is a hedge. It also gives credence to a claim I made a few weeks ago that every time we find a new bipedal primate fossil, it adds chaos to the naturalistic model. And this is one of the best examples of a bipedal primate fossil find that's increasing the chaos rather than resolving the situation from an evolutionary perspective. So, with that, Ted, take you first and we'll go back down.
The thing that comes to my mind is the quality of the brain as well as the size, the interconnection of the brain, the gray matter to white matter ratio, the convolutions, the density of neurons. I can't help but think of the first integrated circuits they came out with. They had 20,000 transistors and about a 4-micron resolution for the lithography. Now they're down to 0.1 micron. And there's 20 million, 30 million, 50 million transistors and less volume than the early chips. And if you were just to go with the size, you would say, well, geez, you know, the chips are the same size. But they obviously have the same capacity. Not so.
Well, that's the difficulty here. The only data they have would be the cranial container. They don't have the brain. And so we have no idea. I mean, all we can measure is the brain size and the approximate brain shape. But you know, as I've mentioned, it's a stretch to say just because it seems to have more of the brain in front of the eyes, therefore it had this big complex frontal lobe that was able to do intellectual activity. I mean, if that were really true, then we should see some archaeological finds that would support that higher intellectual activity. So far, they have found none. Doesn't mean they aren't looking. Obviously, with all these papers being published, there's going to be a concerted search to find that. But there again, I'm already warning in advance. If they find a tool in the same area, that doesn't necessarily mean that was a tool built and used by this creature. Or, as we've seen with the apes that share the planet with us, they will often take our tools and play with them rather than make the tools and use them. I mean, we see that with monkeys all the time. They will steal our tools, but they have no idea how to use them. They're just kind of toys. And therefore, you could expect that there would be tools that would be taken from a site and deposited at a different site. That seems to be a property of all primates. They love to take stuff and carry it around and drop it. And so you see that with monkeys in Africa. Yeah, birds will do that too. They'll carry it off and drop it somewhere. So just the fact that you find a tool in a particular location maybe doesn't give you any real information as to how a species found the same area was using that tool. Okay, now.
Yeah, first of all, according to Science Magazine, it's not a hedge, it's a bush. But
hedge, bush, people call it a lawn, a hedge, a bush. The whole problem is it doesn't look like this.
The other second thing is, tools. I've seen chimpanzees on nature, use tools all the time. So if they have almost close to our hands, these primates, I'm sure they would come up with tools. Even that's almost certain as far as I'm concerned. The next thing is, we know that we're pretty certain now that because of DNA, in our DNA, they found traces of Neanderthal. So we did mate with them.
That's so disputed out. Okay, there's no real evidence that that's the case.
How about this? Is there any? This is great if they could find evidence of say, a sperm samples of some of these primates and compare it to ours. Do you think they would be the same?
Well, we're not going to find the sperm cells.
I know that, but I mean, if they look,
after all, how long does your sperm last, right?
Like us, and they do look like us. Look at them. They must have. If they lived together, they probably would have made it. I'm sure of that. Aren't you?
Okay.
Well,
but this is something that's going on in the literature. There's a debate whether or not there was any interbreeding between humans and Neanderthals. And we have several podcasts on that you can get off of our website. And one I participated in a little more than a year ago, which is the one that's cited most frequently, is a study done by a dozen researchers where they looked at the DNA of the Y chromosome of Neanderthal and compared it with the Y chromosome of people living in different regions. And what they noticed, first of all, is that the Y chromosome of Neanderthals differed from humans by 1%. That's a huge difference. And on that basis, they said, it's got to be a separate species. It can't be a species that is in any kind of evolutionary lineage. That was a discovery that settled it once and for all, that Neanderthal was a side branch and not something that led to human beings. 1% may not sound like a lot, but it is a lot, particularly when you look at the kind of the DNA of Neanderthal that differs with human DNA. You find a bigger difference in terms of the brain structure than the rest of the organs. But what caused people to think that there might be some interbreeding going on is they found that the Neanderthal DNA was very slightly more similar to Europeans and Asians than it was to Africans living below the Sahara. And so the feeling was that when humans migrated out of Africa and into Europe, those migrating into Europe, a few of them had intercourse with Neanderthals. That explains why there's this slight difference. Okay, here are the caveats. What they found in terms of a difference added up to what's called a 3-sigma result. That sigma means standard deviation. And one standard deviation means maybe there's a 67% probability that it actually took place. 2-sigma means there's about 90% or 95%. 3-sigma, you're getting close to 99%. But in science, the rule of thumb is you cannot call it a positively verified discovery unless it's 5 standard deviations. This is only 3. And so statistically, the thing may evaporate with future studies. The other thing that caught my suspicion is I looked at the 12 researchers. The 12 researchers were all Asians and Europeans. There were no sub-Saharan Africans that were part of the research study. And why that is significant it's a tremendous challenge to take DNA from a Neanderthal bone, for example, and avoid any human contamination. And in this particular group, they worked very hard at trying to keep the contamination out, but they couldn't guarantee that they had done so. Now, here's a way it could be resolved. Repeat the study using sub-Saharan African researchers and see what results you get. I mean, if you get a different result, then you know you've got a contamination issue.
Dr. Ross, looking at people that we know now, right, as we know humans, you don't think that these people coming out of Africa 60,000 years ago, and they see another group that looks like them almost, you don't think they would have made it? Come on, with all your experience and our experience that we know.
Okay, let me finish, Al. Let me finish. Okay. That's kind of where the research stands. It's a three sigma result, and the researchers were Asians and Europeans, so maybe this isn't what they think it is. And then there's been a new discovery showing that humans didn't enter Europe until about 48,000 years ago. If that is the case, then that guarantees that humans never had physical contact with Neanderthal. It only would work if you actually have Neanderthals persisting until about 35,000 years ago. Because humans didn't enter Europe until 35,000 to 40,000 years ago. So that 48,000 year date stands up, and already the researchers are convinced it's a more reliable date than the date that got published as 35,000 years. If that's the case, then this whole study has been discounted. On the other hand, you're raising an interesting point. Because the researchers noted that if this is evidence that some interbreeding took place, it's at a far lower level of interbreeding than what we see in the human population today. And what they're referring to was a practice of bestiality, where humans will have intercourse with animals. It happens. That's part of the sin of humanity. God told us not to do it, but there are a few people who do it anyway. But they said the signal, if it's real, is so weak that the level of bestiality 30 to 40,000 years ago would have to be a whole lot less than it is today. In other words, this signal is at such a weak level that it shows that not much of this was going on. But I do agree with your point. Human beings have been sinners since the Garden of Eden. You can expect bestiality to happen.
That's procreation.
So, but as yet, we have no evidence that this interbreeding took place. But one thing we did comment, because in our podcast we said, what if it turns out that it's real, that the interbreeding really did take place? Well, we know that the level of interbreeding is so weak, it has zero impact on the image of God. And from a theological perspective, we shouldn't be surprised that Satan and his demons are trying to motivate humans into the practice of bestiality. That's because it told us right there in Genesis 3 that Satan would attack the image of God. And what better way to attack the image of God than to mess up our DNA through bestiality? So we shouldn't be surprised from a biblical perspective that this kind of thing would be going on. On the other hand, we shouldn't be surprised either that God would intervene in such a way to protect the image of God. And that's one thing that comes through the DNA evidence, is that the image of God is intact. The signal is so weak, it has no impact in terms of our physical features today. And also you made the comment that these creatures look like us. Well, we now know that they did not look like us. They were. Well, yeah, but that's an artist's rendition. Okay.
Can I comment on the looking like this thing in the illustration part?
Well, I mean, this, for example, is the fossil of the Homo sapiens idaltu, and the skull is not like our skull. And when you look at the Neanderthal skull, let me see if I got one here for Neanderthal. Well, this is an artist's rendition, sorry. It's not the actual skeleton. But probably the biggest differences we see with Neanderthals, their arms and legs were a lot shorter than ours, and they were barrel-shaped. So they were a lot rounder than we were. and very muscular, probably had a very good sense of smell, definitely stronger than we are, may not have been able to run as fast as we could run, and the way their brain was shaped was quite different than us, but one of the biggest differences was their nasal capacity. They had an enormous nasal capacity. Now, everything we see about Neanderthal is what you'd expect from a creator creating a bipedal primate to live in a cold climate. And that's where these creatures lived. They lived in Europe and Siberia, where it gets cold in the wintertime. And if you're not wearing clothes, you're going to want to have short limbs and a barrel-shaped body. That's going to help you hold your heat in. And you're especially going to want a really big nasal capacity. What that nasal capacity does is allows you to breathe in cold air and warm that air up before it gets down into your lungs. And that's something we humans are not very well adapted for. When it's 40 below, you'd better be wearing one of these fancy parkas, which has all this fur going out, and you kind of look through a tunnel. I mean, I've lived in places like that. And what that fancy parka does, it acts like an artificial huge nasal capacity. Warms the air up before it gets to your nose, so when it goes down into your lungs, you don't sear your lungs from the cold temperature. Neanderthal had that built into his anatomy. The other thing we notice is that if you look in the skull, the hole that takes the spinal column, and try to remember which way it is. For humans, it's, I think, circular, and for Neanderthal, it's elliptical. And so they got a different size hole, and this is something that's unique to the Neanderthal. And also, anatomists have pointed out Neanderthal is the only bipedal primate we find that has this huge nasal capacity. In fact, it's the only land mammal we know of that he has that huge nasal capacity. And so there again is something we wouldn't expect from an evolutionary perspective. But I can tell you this. When I was being educated as a high school student and as a college student, we were taught that Neanderthals were anatomically identical to human beings. That's no longer in the textbooks. We now know they have significant anatomical differences with respect to human beings. So,
pretty down far south. They found them, I think, where is it? The southernmost part that they found it, I think, in Spain. And that's pretty warm.
I mean, well, yeah, but Spain gets cold winters, too. So, I mean, we do see, I mean, if I can go back to this one, this is the Neanderthal-like species that we see in the tropics. And we do see anatomical differences between Homo sapiens idaltu and Neanderthal. But there are differences between both and human beings. Okay, I don't know who's next. We got Steve back there. We got Dave here. Go for you. What's up, Steve?
Thanks. I just wanted to bring in the different side of theistic evolution, which I think you appreciate. Some degree. The fellow you mentioned in England, I can't remember his name either, but he would be a Christian who says that evolution does show design and gives glory to God by the use of convergence. And better patterns to what we see in Genesis, what we call progressive portion of Genesis, especially to day 3 and day 5, where we don't have the creation words of saw, barah, or
Right. Sar.
Right. And so I know you'd agree with day 3 when it says that let the lamb produce, and then it produced. That's different, and it shows that something more naturalistic, which this fellow would say naturalism is really part of creation and glory to God. Day 5 is the same, where it says, let the earth, the ocean swarm. But then, day 5 is an unusual thing. Its response is, and then God created bara. So there's a difference there. And on that day 5, I think that is where the nefesh comes in, at the Cambrian explosion is what's not, of course. RTD, your day 6 starts, most people, I think, put the division between day 5 and day 6 at 251 million years ago when there's a Permian catastrophe. But RTD's day 6 puts it way past birds and so forth. So when we talk about the nefesh, I think we're not talking about birds or whatever modern animals. We're talking about very primitive animals, previous 251 million years ago.
Well, you can listen to the podcast that we had with this gentleman. It was about 2 hours long. And, he does admit, he confesses that he's a believer. And we found a lot of common ground. He talked about the term progressive creation, and he says, I'm somewhat comfortable with that. But he was reluctant to tell us exactly what kind of theistic evolutionist he was. He says, I'd rather not talk about it. Let's just stick to the data. But just so you get a proper perspective and the model we have at Reasons to Believe, we do believe that creation day 5 is the beginning of the Cambrian explosion. Although Fuzz might say maybe we should push it back to the Avalon explosion, but it's kind of where you see the first animals showing up in the oceans, 543 to 575 million years ago, somewhere in that range. Well, I mean, we're not being dogmatic on that, because after all, the text isn't dogmatic. But we're saying it seems that they could get the best fit by putting it in with the Cambrian and the Avalon explosions. I like the astronomy, too, because that puts you right after the solar system goes through a spiral arm.
The point I wanted to make was more on day 5, day 6 boundary, at 251 million years ago. I don't know where it puts it, where do you put it?
Well, I mean, we're not claiming that you can put a very precise date in the boundary between creation day 5 and 6. But just to be clear, we're saying day 5, we get these swarms of small creatures in the seas, uses the verb, let the land or the oceans produce, and then it uses the verbs asaw and bara, which we believe is a reference to the soulish animals, the birds and the sea mammals that God created later on day 5. And that fits well the fossil record. And then day 6, the text jumps ahead to God creating 3 different kinds of advanced land mammals. And exactly where you put that date, that could vary over the map. I mean, I get kind of disturbed by people saying, Hugh, please give us a timeline for all the events in Genesis 1. That's difficult because the text isn't all that specific about exactly what kind of animals are showing up there. And moreover, the dates that we can get from the scientific record aren't that accurate either. But lay people always want us to give us a date that's accurate to 3 places a decimal. We can't do that. So, but we make some suggestions.
I propose that the words are, such as in day 5, a Hebrew word for bird is pitzvah. Day 5, it uses oath, which is shown in Exodus and other places with Moses, is a winged animal. But we had winged dinosaurs at this time. So I'm saying that I'm calling into question, namely, the graph up there, a tree versus a hedge. People who take the hedge view there are theistic evolutions who take that. I think this guy from England might. I don't know. Mainly because...
He does. He frankly does.
Yeah, so he's glory to God. And so when we say evolution, there's a difference between RTD evolution, of saying that there's been multiple creations repeated at the species level, and theistic evolutions who say there's been multiple guided creation to conversions that gives glory to God.
Right, and where this gentleman in England would stand is he takes a position that's quite distinct from your typical American theistic evolutionist, because he would claim, the fellow in England, that there are ways science can uncover God intervening in the record of nature, whereas the people I hear in the States, especially from BioLogos, they say God's involved, but we can't figure out how or why. So, again, we've talked about this before. There's a range of perspectives under the title theistic evolution, just like there's a range of perspective under the title of progressive creation. Dave, you're next.
2A, obviously no more questions this time. But my comment, that wasn't why I raised my hand. Obviously one of the ones that you pointed out on Neanderthal that makes it very distinct was the no-tear ducts.
No-tear ducts.
Between the nasal capacity and no-tear duct, makes them very distinct, obviously, than humans and people to try and make this association with ancestors. We find no recessive genes of large nasal capacities or no-tear ducts. Everybody's born with one.
Right.
So that was my point.
And again, that's understandable for a creature designed for a cold climate. You've got tear ducts. What happens when you get into a really cold place? Your eyes begin to tear. And if it's cold, they freeze, and that's not a good thing. Again, you got to wear clothes. And everything that we know about Neanderthal, he was naked. We see no evidence that they ever developed a clothing technology. And just to wrap this thing up on tools, You know, whenever they find tools with these creatures, the real question was, do they show any inventiveness with the tools? Are they taking patents out on the tools, for example? And what I mean by that is, as we look at these bipedal primates that are not humans, what we notice is that their tool technology doesn't evolve. That's unique to human beings. Our tools experience rapid evolution with respect to time. The other thing we notice is you see an instantaneous development of complex tools once humans show up. Immediately we see, for example, carved needles made out of ivory with a hole in it that obviously can be used for sewing. And just like you see in the book of Genesis, as soon as human beings rebelled against God, clothing came into effect. And that meant they needed tools that they could use for making clothing, and that shows up immediately. Whereas for all the other bipedal primate species, we see no tools that allow that. We don't see tools, for example, with barbed fish hooks that you can use to catch fish. That's missing. You're basically limited to what are called the flake tools, even for Neanderthal. That's really all you see is a creature taking a boulder, smashing it against another rock, getting some flakes and chips off of that that they can use to scrape meat off the bones. That's the limit of advancement that you see until humans show up. With humans, immediately you've got axes with wood and stone and sinews tied up to make a shovel, to make an axe. And you see needles, saws, all that shows up right away. And then you begin to see a gradual advancement in the tools where they're using metals and bones, etc. Okay, we'll take this up next week. And I promise you, next week we will get to the Neanderthals and what's so distinct about Neanderthals with respect to humans. We're also going to look at Homo erectus. But again, what we're seeing here in terms of the bipedal primates is evidence for a hedge or a lawn, a bush, whatever you want to call it, not an evolutionary tree, and really supports the idea that God was involved in a very intimate way. And we're also going to talk about why God would make these species. It's actually crucial for what was going to happen to the future human species. God made these bipedal primate species, all these different kinds, because he knew human sin was coming. And so we'll show you exactly how these bipedal primates played a role in dealing with the future appearance of human sin. So God knew ahead of time, long before Adam and Eve were in the Garden of Eden, exactly what would happen, and actually designed these bipedal primates to deal with the problem of human sin. So hopefully that will encourage you to come back. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for creating these different species, Lord, and how you actually built them into your grand plan to deliver the human species from sin and evil once and for all. Thank you, Lord, for the fact that you created us to be the centerpiece in this plan of yours to rid the entire creation of all sin and evil. Father, I pray that you would help us and instill us with your Holy Spirit in such a manner that we can be used in the most effective way possible to complete the task of eliminating all evil and all suffering. Lord, make us willing servants to that end, I pray. In Jesus' name, amen.
You missed the petition. It will be over by the piano.
Question. Earlier you mentioned that Satan and demons.
Yes.
If someone does something malicious, like commit a heinous act like murder or what have you, does Satan or the demons, do they attack the conscience or the brain and persuade them in a spiritual wickedness in order to do that? Because I know that human beings are fallen in their evil. They can do it on their own, but is there more of a powerful influence from the demonic realm to attack the conscience? Do you understand my question?
I do. Yeah. Let me turn this off.